Good evening and welcome to the September 3rd of 2024 Kitsap County Planning Commission meeting. Thank you for your participation. We will begin with introductions. It should be noted that Commissioners Joey Zoeller has resigned from the board, and Commissioner Smith and Kaltenborn are absent today. Okay, and we will start online. Introductions.
Steve Bowe, Central Kitsap.
Thank you.
Aaron Murphy, North Kitsap.
Thank you.
Alan Beam, Central Kitsap. Richard Shattuck, Central Kitsap.
Jonathan Tudan, South Kitsap.
And Joe Phillips, North Kitsap. Now to go over the hybrid meeting protocols, please silence all electronic devices during the meeting. If attending in person, please refrain from conversations with others to allow a clear, audible recording of the meeting. On comments, for those wishing to make comment, please state your name and general area of the county that you are residing in when you begin your comments. There are four options available. Those in attendance can raise their hands to indicate they wish to speak, and the chair will recognize you, and you can come to the podium to speak. Those attending via Zoom can click on the raise hand feature to indicate they wish to comment. Your name will be called and your link will be unmuted. Phone attendees can dial *9 to indicate they wish to comment. The last four numbers of your phone number will be called and your number will be unmuted. The final method is to provide written comments to staff at awalston@kitsap.gov by 2 p.m. the day of the meeting. Written comments should include the date of the meeting the comments are meant for, the commenter's name, general area of residence, and the agenda item or subject you're addressing. Public comments are limited to 2 minutes in the public hearing period. Those times are adjustable at the chair's discretion. Okay, for the adoption of the agenda. It should be noted that we have only three of the minutes to be adopted. The last three are deferred to the next meeting. If there are no objections, we will adopt the agenda as presented. Hearing none, the agenda is adopted. Okay. Brings us to the adoption of the minutes. Do I have a motion to review the minutes or approve the minutes?
I move that we approve the minutes presented by staff for the dates March 26, April 2, and April 16.
Do I have a second?
I second.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hands. And unanimous. Thank you. Okay. That brings us to our first public comment period of the meeting. And Mr. Palmer.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. In reference to your work study item on the comprehensive plan, I had a chance to go over a lot of the comments that were submitted to the final EIS. And I was quite disappointed to find that the comments are listed, but there was no response to the comments. Now, I've written several a draft and final environmental impact statements, including two or three for non-projects. And I always had to address the comments that were submitted. I think it's a deficient analysis on the part of staff when they put together the final EIS, or if they involved a consultant, that was no response to comments. Further, I submitted a letter to the Board of County Commissioners that was supposed, on behalf of the Kitsap Alliance of Property Owners, that was supposed to be addressed in the final impact statement, and it didn't even show up in the list of comments. So I don't know what happened, but somehow I think the staff dropped the ball when it came to preparing the final environmental impact statement. I think that's a black mark on the whole process. As I think the people that submitted comments deserved a response, they got none. And all the final thing I'll say is you've got presumably just one work study on the comp plan and the EIS, and you're looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of material. And to go through that in one agenda setting just seems totally incomprehensible to me. That's it for now.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your comments, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Doug Heyman.
Thank you, Planning Commissioners. Doug Heyman, I live in North Kitsap. I just wanted to comment, I've been hearing both in the Board of Commissioners meetings and in some of these, this notion that housing and homelessness is being, you know, sort of degraded by not allowing large developments of single family homes. And I think we really need to have a realistic discussion about the various housing levels that are needing, the missing middle and the lower income as well. And just to bring to the forefront that we can't, you know, fill our housing needs just by building, you know, $700,000 single family homes and upscale housing projects. We need to be looking at all the other tiers of housing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your comments. All right, seeing no one else wishing to speak, we'll close the public comment period, and we will start item F, the work study for the 2024 comprehensive plan update. Mr. Baker. Should be red. There, try it now.
We are unable to hear the podium.
Nope.
Online has no audio.
Let's make sure that online can hear them.
But you, can you hear me, Aaron? Or can you hear us?
Yeah, okay. I can hear Amanda. I cannot hear Eric.
All right. All right, give me just 1 second. I'm going to see if I can grab someone from IS real quick. One moment.
Yep.
For those listening in and watching, we're having some audio difficulty for a moment here, so please stand by.
Carefully, Eric. No jinxing.
What was the magic?
Okay.
All righty.
We're back.
For the record, my name is Eric Baker. I'm with the Kitsap County Commissioner's Office. Before I get into my presentation, would it be okay to respond to some of the questions? I think I can provide some feedback on that. One moment here. I'm going to show on my screen what is, if you go to the comprehensive plan EIS and you go to Appendix E, which is the DEIS comment response matrix, which is what I'm going to show here on the screen. So this is the DEIS response matrix, which you will note, you can't note here because it's too small. Let's try a little bigger. This is all of the comments that have been received on the draft environmental impact statement. We did record both the comment and the response to comments on each one of these. Indicates whether it's a letter or an email. And also, I believe here under number 312, the Kitsap Alliance of Property Owners email came in, and their response can be found. Let me get to the page number of that. Mr. Palmer can take a look. Page 36 of the comment matrix related to the draft environmental impact statement. I'm going to stop there. So the purpose of today's work session, again, this is not your only work session. You actually have tonight, and then you have one again 2 weeks from tonight, and then you have your public hearing. So the purpose of what I was looking for today, which again isn't quite as important as what you were looking for today, is to kind of give a refresher of where we were back in March. I know you guys lived and breathed this for a good amount of time, but that has been a few months ago. So I just want to go through some of the basics. Wanted to be able to catalog any additional data needs the Planning Commission might be looking for that we could bring back to the next work study and then have a back and forth conversation on those items before going to the public hearing, which is on September 24th. Any concerns regarding that strategy?
No.
All right. Well, I will not go into as much depth as I did previously. This is more of a refresher. or a re-entry. Pretty much what we're looking for in this comprehensive plan, amongst all the things that have to be done in comprehensive plans every 8 to 10 years, it used to be 8, it's now 10, are three main components. The first of which is housing, the second of which is climate change, and the third of which is vital regional and countywide centers. As you heard me talk throughout this process, Kitsap County is suffering from a lack of affordable housing to people making less than 80% of annual median income. The Department of Commerce provided us both numbers and housing types as to what types of housing are available to people making 80% or less. Largely, that is multifamily housing and a small amount of attached housing. So attached housing being townhomes, et cetera. Without that type of housing, there's a significant chunk of our residents that aren't able to find homes and are currently living with their parents. Parents are living with their kids because they aren't able to afford a household of their own. So a lot of this comprehensive plan is really focusing on how do we expand multifamily and single family attached capacity. As currently we are dramatic, the way we are today, we're dramatically under capacity in multifamily and over capacity in single family detached. I'll show a little more of that in a moment. Climate change. House Bill 1181 was approved in 2023 that requires jurisdictions to have climate change chapters. For us, that is not required until 2029, but with 271 miles of shoreline, multiple floodplains, and only aquifers as a water source, 5 years from now is probably too late to get started on that. So this draft plan includes Kitsap County's first climate change element and establishes a foundation for future conversations. It is not the whole climate change package. It is a commitment to have this conversation moving forward and creating some established sideboards. And then lastly, with the significant number of folks who are moving to Kitsap County, we need to focus them in regional and countywide centers like Silverdale, Kingston, the McWilliams area north of Rydell Road, and to a degree, places like Bethel Road in South Kitsap. Currently, these are areas that are employment, retail, or service-driven. They're not places people go to live. People drive in, they drive out. It's not a 24/7 community. Centers are not walkable or bikeable and have limited transit. We need to work on folks living, working, and playing all in the same area. And if they need to move around their community, they have other options rather than getting in their single-passenger vehicle. So we talked a lot about the math of this comprehensive plan. It all kind of comes down to supply and demand. There's a demand for a number of people or jobs or homes. There is the amount of land that you have for that. When we were doing this plan, we took a look and we saw a series of alternatives. We reviewed three. I'm showing here the preferred alternative as the Planning Commission boiled those three alternatives down to one. And that was further refined by the Board of County Commissioners in April. So what you're seeing here is in the preferred alternative, we are currently planning for 6,000 more people than we are required to do so. In alternative two of the draft alternatives, that number was 8,000 over. I'll explain why we're over in the number of population here in a moment. But what you're seeing here is that this is a reduction in the number of people being accommodated, but still significantly over the amount that that has been allocated. Why is that? Because we are responsible for providing for housing types. And like I mentioned earlier, we are dramatically short in multifamily capacity. If you take a look at the chart located up there, you'll note that in alternative one, which is our no action alternative, the way we stand today, we have 2,000 units of multifamily capacity for the next 20 years. If you look to the column to the second to the left, you'll note that the Department of Commerce indicates our need is 8,300. So that would be dramatically more multifamily units than we currently have capacity for. In alternative two, we did our best to come as close to that number as possible. The Planning Commission, when they reviewed it, they had gone largely with alternative two. However, a certain number of things occurred after the Planning Commission made their recommendation. The first of which was that certain single-family residential or single-family residential zones that were UGA expansions were removed from the alternative. We received a lot of public comment about concerns about expansions of urban growth area boundaries, both from the community and agencies. So due to the fact that we are oversupplied in single-family detached zoning and undersupplied in multifamily zoning, those UGA expansions were removed by the Board of County Commissioners. Additionally, we have taken into account the entirety of the March 8th draft of the Critical Areas Ordinance, which I'll talk about here in a moment. That put increased buffers by 50 feet on fish and non-fish streams. That has not yet been adopted, but the preferred alternative takes that into account. Obviously, that is going to impact developable land, so now there are fewer units and fewer people who are able to be accommodated. And then lastly, there is a current proposal for tree canopy regulations. That is trees on top of your critical areas that you would need to include in your development. That also takes away a certain amount of land, and which then, when you take away the land, you take away the capacity for homes and for people. I do want to indicate that that is not a one-to-one math problem. Just because you take away 1 acre, there is an opportunity for people to be, for homes to be built differently. It may make certain housing types much harder, like single family detached, but a number of those units, if it can pencil, which ultimately is the one thing that all projects need, is to be able to be affordable, even by the public. We need to make sure that it's an affordable project. That you can recapture some of those units, even if the area is being protected by the critical areas or being required to be left in trees per a future tree canopy requirement. I'm going to pause there. As I said, a lot of words and I threw out a lot of numbers. Largely what you see here is that we are roughly short about 1,200 total units countywide. And of those multifamilies, we're short about 800. 900, 800? Are short about 800 multifamily units. This is as close as we could come while still trying to balance our traditional way of sizing our urban growth area boundaries, which is the population number. Going over in population was something that we avoided at all costs in the past. With the new housing numbers and our existing urban growth area boundaries, we've been encouraged to overplan to ensure that we have those housing types. However, that does not negate the fact that population is kind of the barometer for how big your urban growth areas need to be. So we are kind of sitting in the middle on this one. We've tried our best to accommodate both requirements. And a lot of what you're going to see in this plan is our attempt to thread a very, very skinny eye of the needle on a number of these. And only time will tell as to whether we've been successful. Any questions? All right, like I mentioned, I was going to talk about the critical areas ordinance. We are operating under the March 8th draft where streams, both fish and non-fish, are potentially going to increase in buffer width by 50 feet. And like I mentioned, that's not necessarily a one-to-one loss of housing. Why is that? A significant amount of our population is being focused in areas that already have development in it, like downtown Silverdale, like the Kingston area. So these areas have already had their critical area hits. So it doesn't have quite as much of an impact on those developments. Existing ravines and associated wetlands. A lot of streams have associated wetlands, which means that their buffer is already absorbed into a wetland. So it was already protected. Additionally, we have excised ravines. So oftentimes very similarly, 200 feet, you're not outside the ravine yet. The ravine can't be developed either. The housing types I mentioned before, you are allowed to cluster. We're providing a lot of flexibility. And also the critical areas affect a lot of the low density zones like urban restricted, where the fewest number of people were being planned already. So when you take a look at those numbers I showed you, and it's like, wow, how did the critical areas ordinance not have a larger impact? Those are the reasons why it did not have a larger impact. I'm going to stop there because I know you've been talking about the critical areas ordinance, so this problem may have prompted some questions. All right.
Fairly silent
tonight. I know. I'm worried. you guys are keeping your powder dry. And then lastly, employment. Population, employment, and housing are the delightful math components. What you see here is the preferred alternative in regards to employment. Alternatives 1, 2, and 3 did not accommodate the number of units necessary or the number of jobs necessary. During the conversation on the preferred alternative, the Board of County Commissioners added in some additional industrial land. That additional industrial land provided a substantial number of additional jobs. So instead of being almost 1,000 people light in jobs, we now not only have we're pretty close to equilibrium. 146 jobs, that's pretty close to the pin. Not only do we have a pretty close to the right number of jobs, we also have found locations for industrial jobs. As we're talking about these walkable communities, industrial zoning and industrial uses don't fit in your walkable communities. They take up a significant amount of land. Oftentimes they're noisy, oftentimes they're smelly. It's the type of thing you don't put a lot of residential around. However, those are incredibly important jobs to our community, especially with our Navy focus. So we needed to find locations for that. I'll show you on the map where those were located, which generally are around other industrial areas. So just as a summary, the board's preferred alternative, pretty much all rural to rural reclassification requests were pushed to 2025 for a full rural conversation. So topics like Rainier, the proposed rezone that included a concurrent proposal, the Y, is also being postponed to 2025. Urban growth area expansions are limited to those that increase housing diversity, provide industrial opportunities, like I just mentioned, or support city annexation goals. Those are the ones that we're looking at. We reviewed the critical area limitations, like I just described, and we established tree canopy requirements. That was the direction of the board. So I'm just going to briefly go through what the elements of the comprehensive plan are. The comprehensive plan is our aspirational document. That's what we want to be when we grow up. But we really want to be a lot of different things. And they don't always play together well. So as you're reading through the goals and policies and you see words like ensure, you note that you have to ensure this goal, which might have a conflict with the ensuring of a goal in another chapter. Some people will take and they'll read it and say, no, you said that you were going to make this happen. And on that property, that didn't happen. It's like, no, ultimately, the comp plan, the development regulations all need to be married together to be able to meet that middle ground. But the land use chapter is really the meat. That is the zoning portion that establishes your urban zones, your rural zones, and your resource zones. It includes a series of goals and policies, again, focusing on the walkability, the transit opportunities. It also talks about various code elements, such as attempting to provide compatibility with existing development. In Kitsap, that is a particular challenge because a lot of our development in some of our urban growth areas are pre-GMA, so they're much larger lots, and now they see much smaller lots coming in next to them. As I'm talking about all these incentives to increase density, one thing that I've said a few times during this, and I want to say again, we're not just talking about additional density opportunities in new developments. We're also talking about development opportunities in existing developments. If there's that vacant lot next to you or that mobile home that potentially could be removed, when I talk about the allowances of triplexes, fourplexes, that could apply to those lots as well. So it isn't just a new 10-lot short subdivision. It is also individual existing lots that are in place today. So I want to make sure that that is an impact that the public understands, as it could be something beyond just a large lots. It could be little lots throughout their existing developments. Again, this is also where we're promoting housing. We are making sure that we are providing opportunities for agricultural uses, not commercial agriculture, but agricultural uses in our rural areas, as well as protecting mining and timber. We have the economic development chapter that really is focused on leveraging our naval presence while also diversifying our economy, something we've been trying to do for 20 plus years. Also, with the increased ferry service, we have a number of employees that are working from home in our community that happen to be working in Seattle, and grappling with that reality has also been a challenge. We want to explore emerging industries and technologies while still acknowledging our naval presence. and we need to find ways to keep from displacing small minority-owned businesses. Obviously, as businesses grow, some do not, and that growth sometimes can push out small business owners. Housing, this is where I've talked a lot about already. We want to ensure we have sufficient housing stock. We're improving diversity. Again, single-family detached housing is likely not the way that we are going to be able to provide for all the folks that are coming here at price points that people can't afford. And when we talk about the price of housing, we're not just talking about the price of homes. We're talking about the cost of property taxes. That is another component that even people who own their homes can be impacted by increased property values in a way that could make them housing unstable over time. It's encouraging multifamily missing middle housing, townhomes, cottage housing, infill development. Those are those small lots that I was talking about that happen to be located in and around existing development. And then again, we're trying to mitigate displacement risks. We want to make sure that we aren't taking away affordable housing units with a new housing stock. How do we go about making sure that that is happening at its absolute, the least amount possible? The environment, this is where the critical areas ordinance comes into effect. It's also the shoreline code. We want to enhance urban tree canopy, like I mentioned, but this isn't just a regulatory document. That's what everybody tends to focus on. It's also incentive-based. Kitsap County and the state has a series of incentive programs that allow us to acquire lands, as well as develop strategies to acquire full watersheds, et cetera. I know a lot of the environment has been regulation-based. But honestly, Kitsap County has acquired more than 5,000 acres of open space just in the last 10 years, many of those wetlands and streams. The Great Peninsula Conservancy, Forterra, all these agencies are also acquiring lands. So there are other ways to protect resources other than regulation, and this chapter covers a lot of that. Climate change, this is the new chapter. It establishes a foundation to meet state climate planning legislation. What you're going to find in the environmental impact statement, that is going to be extremely challenging when you look at the numbers related to vehicle miles traveled and the greenhouse gas emissions that are related to them. The numbers we put in there have only a small amount of the transit that is necessary to be able to make this happen. We want to be clear on that so that we're showing that we need to take substantial action if we're going to meet some of these greenhouse gas emission goals. And then also, because so much, 271 miles of shoreline often means that we have a lot of roads, sewer plants, other infrastructure that's located close to shorelines and floodplains. Sea level rise is going to impact all these over time. How are we going to be prepared just for regular sea level rise, not to mention those king tides that we've been seeing so often that happen to come with heavy rainfall and weird barometric concerns that are flooding out both private and public properties. We need to be preparing more for that, and we need to determine what that might look like. Parks, we need to make sure that we have adequate parks, both active and recreational. Active and passive, active being fields, passive being trails and open space. We want to increase the protection of tree canopy and really focus on a number of the environmental factors. And we want to explore funding. The Parks Department is always one of the first places cut during an environmental downturn. That is not the best way to maintain our park system. However, we have a very robust stewardship committee or stewardship groups that really help plug that hole. One thing that we did get a lot of testimony about, and we expect to hear more testimony about, is the Port Gamble Forest Heritage Park. That's located up, not surprisingly, south of Port Gamble. There was a document that was developed called the Framework that had a series of environmental protections, but also had a series of proposed recreational uses. There are concerns related to that. So you'll note a very limited number of references to the framework in this document, except for a strategy that indicates that before any major projects are taken on, new ones, so not including the ride park that's already there, the Stottlemyre Trailhead, or potentially the Sound Olympics Trail, new projects, we must complete a better environmental analysis, mainly focused on wildlife corridors. That is something that's absent from the framework and something that is very important, especially if the Sound Olympics Trail is going to be running through that area. which could potentially be a wildlife barrier. I say that as, again, I do expect that you'll be hearing a certain amount of that, and you've probably already read a certain amount of that. Transportation, make sure that we're providing adequate levels of service, that we aren't dealing with an inordinate amount of congestion. And when we are, we make sure that we are planning for projects to address that. But like I mentioned before, single family pasture vehicles are not the way that we are going to be able to successfully handle our future population. We're never going to have a light rail system. In my lifetime, we're probably not going to have a light rail system. But what we do need to expand is our transit system. Transit needs to be a thing in Kitsap County. Historically, it's been something, we really don't want to go down that road. But honestly, robust living communities need transit to be able to accommodate that many people in such a small space and get people around the community, not just between communities. You can get to work, you can get back, you just can't stop at a grocery store along the way. You got to get home, you got to get in your car, you got to drive to the grocery store, and then you got to drive back. The future growth, there is no amount of money that can pencil our way out of that. We can't pave our way out of it is what I meant. We want to support electric vehicle infrastructure. And like I mentioned, setting levels of standard, levels of service standards, ones that have a clear connection to things such as capacity, but also safety. So our transportation element is robust in that way. Capital facilities, it isn't just about roads, it's the pipes come in there too, stormwater, water. Also facilities like sheriff services, fire services, school services. Where are all these people and their children going to go to school? How will, again, people be able to receive EMT services? We've been working very closely with our special purpose districts as well as our internal county departments on exactly what that might look like. And then we have subarea plans, which, again, are specialized plans that have bits and pieces of all the elements I just discussed, but only focused on their specific areas. We made very few changes to most of the subarea plans, especially the rural ones. Keyport, which is rural, Manchester and Suquamish, very few changes. Illihee and Gorst, they are urban. They also did not receive any changes. However, not surprisingly, as Kingston and Silverdale are intended to be our regional growth centers, or regional and countywide growth centers, we had to significantly revise those to be able to accommodate the new population and employment and housing types. So I'm not going to go into I'll just blow through these. Basically, this is what the Kingston urban growth area ended up looking like. We did remove a piece of urban medium located up there off Linvog Road. There was a big rectangle that was removed due to concerns about urban growth area expansions. Again, what you're noting here is only the urban growth area expansions or rezones, which what you'll note here is they are very limited, the largest being a piece of arborwood, that is that triangle at the south, that is already part of the arborwood development, can develop urban whether it's in the UGA or not. You also have the center area, like I mentioned. This is where we are really doing, as you'll note, when we're talking about intensifying development, we're doing a lot of primary things. We're increasing heights, we're increasing allowed densities, we're reducing parking requirements, we're increasing transit frequency, and we are attempting to provide expedited permitting for multifamily structures. So when I talk about all of this intensification of development, this is what I'm talking about. And this in the Kingston area would pretty much mean the area around the grocery outlet, as well as portions downtown, not nearly as intense as we get closer to the ferry terminals. So when we're talking about heights, we're talking about going from 35 feet to 55 feet in commercial zones and remaining at 45 feet in a number of the other zones. When we get to Silverdale here in a moment, you'll see those heights get a lot higher. Poulsbo, no changes. We have an interlocal agreement with the city of Poulsbo where we use their code in our UGA. We are working on an interlocal agreement where not only will we use their code, they will do the planning for those projects, which of course makes sense. But there are no changes. The city of Poulsbo feels they can accommodate their population and the population of their UGA in their current configuration. The Silverdale UGA, this is the one I mentioned a moment ago. Also, if you look at the north, there were two single family urban low zones that were removed as urban growth area expansions. The only changes are internal to the Silverdale area. by Greaves Way, and also they're located just south of the new transit station. We want to ensure that we are maximizing those lands where possible. But here you're going to note that the heights are increased. Maximum structure height in the UGA also is going up to 55 feet for commercial. But where it really impacts is the downtown area. There's the opportunity in many places to go to 85 feet, if not 125 feet, with certain incentives. If you provide plazas, if you provide public open space, if you are providing better compatibility with the surrounding area, it is an incentive. You provide that, you're able to go higher. Obviously, height is something that is going to be construction-based. They're penciling taller projects. That's why you usually see projects that are under five stories or over eight. That little space in the middle is really where people don't build because it becomes too expensive for just a couple extra stories. We're trying to provide additional opportunities, especially down in the hospital area, which is kind of into the hillside, where heights of that nature won't be as noticed. I believe the medical center is roughly 85 feet right now. The Central Kitsap Urban Growth Area, there is very little that has changed, though we have, again, intensified densities, intensified heights. We have removed setbacks in a lot of instances, reduced parking, but we also focused on the McWilliams Countywide Center. That is the area located there on McWilliams and SR 303. There is a lot of opportunity for redevelopment of this area, as well as a good number of units already. A lot of these strategies also extend all the way up as we move towards Fairgrounds Road. We do see the McWilliams and the 303 corridor is an area where we can definitely maximize the opportunity for housing, as there are already services present and it is already close to transit infrastructure. East Bremerton, there are no changes that are being proposed other than, again, some increased heights and some increased densities in the urban medium and urban low zones. One thing I do want to note about all of these is that in addition to urban medium, urban high, and the multifamily zones, there is an increased allowed density in the single family zones. From instead of being 5 to 9 dwelling units an acre, you can now do 5 to 14. To get that extra density, you do need to provide for attached housing. So again, it is encouraging people to do attached housing and an opportunity to be able to recapture some of those units that could have been lost from other critical area protections or other limitations on the site. As you'll note, we are not expanding our urban growth areas. So a lot of the land that is going to be developed is land that has been passed over for the last 30 or 40 years. So there's going to be a lot more challenging lots that are developed. And we want to provide as much creativity for development in these areas to avoid unbuildable lots from other potential regulations. The West Bremerton Urban Growth Area is one of those areas that has been expanded. The two areas you see there that aren't in light blue are proposals by the city of Bremerton. The one that is entirely yellow on the northern portion currently has sewer service. Urban growth areas are supposed to include sewer. Rural areas are not. The city of Bremerton is interesting in being able to pull that into their city at some date. And then additionally, the Kitsap Lake southwestern corner that is also being proposed to move into the urban growth area boundary for potential annexation. The city has put a substantial amount of money into water quality improvements in the lake. They want to be able to control the terrestrial uses as well. But the one thing that you will note is the light blue to the south. That is a industrial area that has been expanded beyond what the Planning Commission saw, beyond what Alternative 2 proposed. It added another 40 to 80 acres of potential industrial uses. Everything around that is actually industrially zoned, which when you take a look and you see that residential development just located off to the west, east, you remember, you ask why. That area is actually surrounded by industrial zoning as well inside the city of Bremerton. So again, guidance indicates that industrial uses should be located around other industrial uses to avoid conflicts, but also to provide synergy between industrial uses. This area is close to the highway off of Werner Road, getting you to State Highway 3. That's another look at the property. It is that large rectangle property that was added by the board after the Planning Commission April process. Another piece of industrial land is this L-shaped piece that is located by the Olympic View Industrial Park and Bremen National Airport. Again, this is also an industrial area, so we're expanding industrial uses around like uses. This property is supported by the city of Bremerton. One you'll note is testimony from the Skokomish tribe. That is absent from the preferred alternative. Because I do expect that this will come up during the rest of the process, this property was originally proposed to be commercial. The city, again, did not support the inclusion of the Skokomish property. Also, commercial was not consistent with our comprehensive plan. Commercial should be located around residential for that walkable community. There's no way to get to this other than via car. That was a significant issue. We do expect that the Skokomish tribe may come back in and indicate that they would like, instead of that being commercial, that it would be industrial. They are also in the process of bringing it into Bureau of Indian Affairs land, which basically would mean that regardless what we zone it, they can build what they want on it. That being said, along with the city of Bremerton, that will be a heady, the city of Bremerton not yet supporting this. I think it will be a continued conversation, not to mention the fact that that change would be very late in the process for a significant number of additional jobs, additional trips that could have an impact on our environmental impact statement. And lastly, you have the South Kitsap area. There are no urban growth area expansions. You may remember that there was one triangle-shaped piece out by McCormick Woods. Again, that was urban low and was removed by the Board of County Commissioners due to the fact that we're not looking to expand our urban growth area boundaries with low-density zoning. But what we are doing is we're upzoning the Bethel Corridor substantially to commercial, which also allows for mixed use, it allows for multifamily, it allows for a number of the housing types that we are looking for. If anyone who remembers the comprehensive plan, this area has gone back and forth over the last 20 years from residential. It was a portion of industrial at one point, and then it went to commercial, then back to residential. And now we are proposing to return it to commercial to be able to provide that multifamily housing in a mix with commercial uses, again, focused on walkability. Again, this area will also have an additional density, reduced parking, additional height, all of the things that we've talked about to make projects more pencilable, if that's even a word. Other things we have here, we have parking reductions, both for single family. Historically, we have not allowed garages to be counted towards parking. We're now allowing one stall in a two-car garage to be counted towards your parking amount or your parking. Roughly for each single family detached housing, that's 2.5 spaces. That would be reduced to obviously 1.5, which hopefully will provide opportunities for greater density. A lot of jurisdictions don't have any parking requirements at all. Our code was the most restrictive I could find anywhere in the state of Washington. Additionally, multifamily housing, it is being reduced, but reduced based upon the types of units that are being produced. Units with one or fewer bedrooms, we get one space per unit. With two or more bedrooms, it's 1.5 spaces per unit. So again, trying to encourage people to do some of the smaller units that come at a lower price point that's available to more members and more income bands. Oh, lastly, we have made accessory dwelling units, which is a livable standalone unit that's either inside your home or in a detached building, substantially easier and cheaper to do inside the urban growth area boundaries only. That was consistent with state statute, but also something that we had done previously. Basically, we allow as many as two accessory dwelling units on any single parcel in the urban growth area. However, that does not apply to the rural areas. We probably have seen some of the testimony related to people wanting ADUs in Hansville, Seebeck. The downside is that is additional growth, that is additional people, and especially if it is people, if we're treating it as affordable housing needs to be close to services. Not all of them have vehicles, so putting them out in the hinterlands is not a standard planning practice. So I've already talked a whole lot. I'm going to skip over that one. Talked about tree canopy just last meeting with you. I did want to put it in here if people wanted to have additional conversation. Otherwise, I will skip over it. I know that you have had additional time to digest what I provided a few weeks back. Just briefly, there would be a requirement to maintain a certain number of tree units on your property if you are developing a project with four or more units. We're encouraging larger trees, and we're incentivizing the retention of trees where possible. Basically, trees that are larger are worth more units than trees that are replaced, which in turn is intended to be an incentive. And then we are requiring a certain number of tree units per gross acre. Critical areas, trees with that are greater than 8 inches in diameter count towards these numbers. So if you do have a critical area buffer, those trees, again, greater than 8 inches in diameter, are counted towards that number, as well as landscaping. We talked about retained trees. They got to be healthy. Basically, if you're going to replace the trees, you got to keep them alive. You have to do all the things. And also, if you are going to keep trees, you've got to protect them during development. Development can be very invasive. We want to make sure that you're not creating danger trees where healthy trees once existed. And then just to kind of wrap up, I've kind of already described what this is. We are now in that last two columns of the table at the bottom. We have the documents out. They're being reviewed. I am presenting here to stakeholders, to community groups. There are two public meetings, one virtual next Tuesday and one that is in person next Thursday, as well as meetings before all the citizens advisory, community advisory committees, and well as meeting with the environmental community, home builders, realtors, all to make sure that they are have as much information as possible to be able to participate as the process moves forward. Like I mentioned, I'll be back here on the 17th to answer any questions that you might have. If you have any that have been spurred by my very lengthy presentation, I'll write them down now. If you do have any additional, please send them to Amanda. She will get them to me so that I can be as prepared as possible. But then you'll have a hearing on the 24th. After the hearing, there are deliberations scheduled for the 1st and, if necessary, additional on the 15th of October. On the October 15th, we're hoping that you will also be able to sign your findings of fact. So again, if we're doing deliberations on the 15th, hopefully it is on an isolated number of issues, not the whole thing. So hopefully we can move through deliberations systematically on the 1st and the beginning part of the 15th. And then after that, the Planning Commission would be providing a recommendation to the Board of County Commissioners for the public to testify on October 28th. This is really hoping will be all concluded by December 2nd. With that, I'm done.
Commissioner Shattuck.
Eric, going back to the start of your presentation, there was a note I thought that we were short about 1,400 units. Of housing was the number I recall, and you were saying with multi-housing was 800 or 900 of those units. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't have enough capacity, have the commissioners, by cutting out some of the UGA growth, basically put us in that position? Did we overcut?
If you take a look, while we are under in multifamily, we are still substantially over. We are at where we're supposed to be on single family. So the question would be, where could we add additional multifamily housing? One thing that we do want to prepare ourselves for is that we may need to have conversations in out years, 2025, 2026. Where we have discussions about individual properties and potentially developers agreements to go along with them. to be able to potentially add additional housing units, add additional missing middle multifamily housing units, or more than likely connect those UGA expansions with affordable housing components, things that actually are guaranteed to provide affordable units over time. So yes, we are currently under, though we are still over in population. So largely you're looking at two different calculations. Commerce does it differently for housing than we're doing with population. We are leaving ourselves room for additional conversations. If we're at the number, there is no future conversation.
It just gets me like, you know, we're back to the future where, you know, we did our comp plan and then we had rezone requests that came in throughout the process. And it sounds to me like we're kind of back there. We have a plan, but then we're going to have a back door for what will look like rezone requests as we're going forward.
Well, likely what we are going to have is we are probably going to have an appeal one way or the other. Some people will indicate that you have too many housing units. Another will say you have too many people. If we're appealed and we're lost on the people, that would actually require us to cut additional units from it. So yes, you are 100% correct. I should have started with that. You're 100% correct, but we are in a position where we do need to try to balance these two. We're under in housing, we're over in population, but not as under or over as we were when we started the process. This is a new requirement. I'm hoping that through adjudication and other jurisdictions starting to do this type of planning as well, that we will have greater clarity moving forward. But we are actually one of the first jurisdictions to put out a comprehensive plan. So we're first through the door.
Commissioner Beam.
Going back to the buildable lands, we have these UGAs.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them have been developed. Is there any process going on, say, hey, new guy developer coming in, look here, 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 and here. These are what we think are developable pieces of property.
We do have lands that are mapped underutilized or vacant. That can be made available to a number of individuals, though a lot of the developers in this area know which lots they're going to be looking at. But yeah, that's something that we could provide
think that that'd be attractive. The mm-hmm. second issue on that is, have we asked the owner of the property if they're amenable to do that?
To develop it all?
Yeah.
We do have a reduction in our land capacity that's called unavailable lands deduction. That pretty much indicates that a certain amount of acres aren't going to develop because the property owner doesn't want to.
Understand that, but that's a numbers game. The mm-hmm. question is, when we get down to the real active properties,
mm-hmm.
do we know that Joe Smith is never going to develop that land no matter what you tell him?
Obviously, this plan is being developed on the macro, so I can't necessarily get down to individual properties. There are going to be some that may not want to develop at all. There may be some that are incredibly challenging to develop. But I do believe that in the land capacity analysis, again, looking at 30,000 feet, we did our best guess at how many units are just not going to develop in the 20-year horizon and exactly what properties those may be. But I believe has been mentioned a number of times, monitoring of this is going to be just as important as monitoring of the critical areas ordinance. We need to see exactly what lots are being able to be developed, what impediments have been created by this, and we need to be prepared to make adjustments over time, because again, the county's role in our housing crisis is limited. We only have so much ability to move the market. We only have so much ability to provide something that reduces the price of units. But I do believe that we will be smarter next year than we are today. Maybe not me, but others. And which case then we'll need to be adjusting these regulations over time based upon hopefully not the reality that you're describing, but I can't say you're wrong. That's the one great part about this. I'm not going to be able to tell any of you you're wrong, just that we are looking to try to balance and look at it on a macro level, which kind of keeps us from looking at Joe Blow. We look at all the Joe Blows.
Well, at some point you want to reduce the elevation.
And Yes, and then that is oftentimes where the code comes in, and that's where a lot of our code is really attempted to be flexible, to provide a lot more flexibility to developers, remove the automatic need for a performance-based development or any kind of deviation that would lead to more density. That adds time, that adds cost, and time is currently money in regards to development.
Have we looked at a review to get some priority for which things are more attractive to reduce than others?
In regards to lots or in regards to regulations?
Trying to make it so it's cheaper to build.
Yes, we basically took a look, and we, like I've mentioned, we've not only emptied out the toolkit, we went to Lowe's with a lot of, went and emptied that place out too, with the flexibility in regulations and as many incentives as we are allowed. It is the expedited review that is particularly important to developers, as time is money. One thing that you may note, and you may have heard, the Department of Community Development is currently doing a study to speed all permit processing. So the expedited review may actually be beyond just multifamily, but that expedited review would actually affect other development. Largely, it's speed of processing and maximizing flexibility without additional governmental process. That's what we've tried to limit in the code. That's a lot of words.
All right, Commissioner Tooten.
I have a request of the planning department, and I think my request might be antithetical to the meeting our multifamily housing needs, but I would like to see our planning department provide more robust development standards for urban multifamily open space regulations. Mm-hmm. I think also you have to clearly define what's considered both open space and usable open space. I could be wrong, but I think right now our current zoning is a little weak. I'd like to see the standards set on the size of the development. And I don't believe we currently have that in our code. Am I correct?
You are correct in that there is nothing in the multifamily standards. We do have a 15% landscaping requirement that is based on the whole project area. So that is, there is landscape. I'm not talking about active, usable open space at that.
Yeah.
The performance-based development, if you do need to have flexibility, the performance-based development requires both active and passive open space beyond a regular standard. But outside of those two avenues, and if you want to go higher than our current height requirements, you can provide public plazas to be able to go higher. Other than those three avenues, there is no one specific percentage that is required. Kitsap County has had kind of a love-hate relationship with percentages. Because our land is so site-specific with critical areas and slopes and everything else, that gross percentages in a lot of ways has limited development in a number of ways, especially when we're talking about multifamily. So when we did the multifamily design standards, gosh, now I'm going to say back in 2009, we tried to go the more flexible route, basically allowing the developer and the planner to be able to kind of negotiate the right amount of open space without actually putting a number on it. Whether that's the right answer, I cannot say.
Okay. Well, I see a lot of the development that's happening in South Kitsap and they're not challenging sites, what I'm saying. And I'm seeing a lot of asphalt around three-story structures. And clearly, the amenity space for those people living there is pretty low. So if we can somehow enhance that, I think that would be desirable.
Thanks. Are some of those apartment complexes the ones that are going in there on Sydney Sedgwick? That's actually inside the city of Port Orchard. So that it follows their code. I'm not saying our code's any better, but that's something that we can take a look at and see what we can do to maybe add some additional amenities. It is one of those awkward things where we are trying to fit a lot of different protections in the same amount of land. But your point is well taken. People need a place to be able to congregate because they just aren't going to have it other places.
Hey, quick question about, we talk about housing, and back in my mind, I'm remembering we have the assisted living housing requirement. Where in this do we plug that in?
Assisted living is a combination of multifamily, but also it can be congregate care facilities. Those are located generally in commercial zones. They also can be located in urban high. That's where the assisted living and memory care and things like that tend to pop in, not necessarily straight multifamily units. One thing that we did ask Commerce is, did the multifamily unit requirements include assisted living? And they indicated no, that that's a separate animal. So we're desperately in need of that as well. That's why we are also in our commercial code trying to be as flexible with those uses there, as well as urban medium, urban high, to be able to provide greater opportunities for those types of services, like you see now in, I believe there is one of those located by the trails in Silverdale.
Okay. Anything else?
It may not seem like it, but I am trying to make this as painless and painful. there's a Freudian slip. As painless as possible. There are limits on what I can do with that. But if there are just data points that you see along the way, that just be, it would be good to have, or if they just need to have them pointed to in the document, please let us know. Make sure you contact Amanda. Amanda will send it to me or Colin, and we'll make sure that we come as prepared as possible for our meeting coming up on the 17th.
Thank you for that, Sedgway. I need to remind the commissioners here that we have a system set up that if you have a question or idea that you want to put forward, please send that to Amanda and allow Amanda to send that to the party that will address it. And then we can bring that at an open meeting up. There's a touchy area there of having a meeting via email instead of out in the open. So I remind everyone, please.
And just to expand, the key component of that is for a planning commissioner to send those directly to me and not include all the other planning commissioners.
Right.
So send it to me and I'll disperse to planning commission and staff as needed that way. So
right. And that way we can put it on the agenda and talk about it in the open and that. Okay. Good. Any last questions for Mr. Baker? Okay. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you very much for all the meetings that you have suffered through with me.
And we'll suffer more. Okay. That brings us to the second general public comment period. Mr. Palmer. Mr. Palmer?
Okay, I haven't had a chance to review the comment matrix in detail, but one of the letters that I submitted on behalf of Kitsap Alliance of Property Owners, I don't know that the Planning Commission saw it, but it addresses the issue of why expedited permitting cannot take place in Kitsap County. Now, I know the response is going to be, well, we're working on it and we're making adjustments. We've hired Kurt Lattimore to make an assessment of the department. But the main reason you can't is because you keep adding regulation after regulation. There's no accounting for what the cost of regulation implementation is going to be. The very fact that you're dealing with a tree ordinance is going to have an effect on usable land in urban growth areas. And the expanding the buffers is also going to have an impact. And I heard what Eric said about the increased buffers not having much of an effect on the available land in urban, but it will. Apparently, I'm about out of time. So I think there's, until they deal with deregulation, you're not going to solve the problem of DCD and expedited permitting.
Hey, Mr. Palmer, thank you for your comments. And let's see. I do not see anyone else wishing to comment, so we will close the comment period. And that brings us to the, for the good of the order, or commissioner comments. No? Okay. If there's no objection, I will close the meeting for tonight, and we will be back in 2 weeks. All right. All right. No objection. We're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.